The transistors he's using don't have enough voltage, so he's putting two transistors in series. Or they don't have enough power, he's putting two in series. Or if he doesn't have enough power, he's putting two in parallel.
Oh no, let me describe it again, Dick.
Go for it.
He has a basic transistor audio amplifier, and he's hooking extra speakers up to it. And when he hooks them in parallel, up to three of them, he notices the transistors run very warm, and he's afraid of damaging them. So he wound up and put them in series, and he noticed, of course, the current went down. He also noticed the temperature went down, but he wants to know if you think he's creating a problem with the amplifier by doing that. Whether they're in phase or not, I don't know.
Out of curiosity, what's the total number of speakers he wants to put? Two or four over you, John?
Three speakers seems to be the max he wants to use right now, and they're all 8 ohms.
Okay, almost every good transistorized hi-fi amplifier these days that's worth its salt, that's worth the money you paid, has a fantastic amount of feedback built in. It's called the damping factor. When you have enough feedback built in other words, there's a circuit sampling the voltage coming out of the amplifier that's going to go to the loudspeakers, and it's being fed back into a complicated lead-lag network of the audio amplifier. The reason you're doing that is because, to some degree, if you're a real good hi-fi audiophile, there's always some degree of non-linearity of all of the transistors. By using feedback, you force them into greater linearity. That's good news. The bad news is you end up with less gain. You got to put in some more transistors. But it's easy to make that up these days with integrated circuits. Second of all, as you use that feedback to a greater and greater degree, the real output impedance of the amplifier goes toward zero. The terminals on the output stage of the audio amplifier may say these two terminals are made for 8 ohms. And therefore, the amplifier with an 8-ohm loudspeaker there does give great performance. However, let me drop. Eric, was that you?
Yeah, most commercial amplifiers set up for hi-fi. Actually, they will give you dual ratings. They give you ratings at 8 ohms, they give you ratings at 4 ohms, which is usually a double. But the feedback network deals with it.
Yeah, where I was going with this one, because of the feedback, if you ran the amplifier thoroughly open circuit, you had a broken connection to the loudspeaker, in most cases that would not damage the amplifier. So therefore, by putting speakers in series, coming up with higher impedance is not bad. If he was trying to feed four nearly identical speakers, he could put them in a combination series parallel combination so that two of them in parallel make 4 ohms out of 8, but two of those combinations in series makes the 4 back to 8. So he could make, if he's got 8 ohm speakers and he combines 4 of them just right, the whole amplifier arrangement would be exactly 8 ohms again. But no matter what you do, the amplifier itself, because of the feedback, even into a perfect open circuit, most amplifiers are self-protecting because of that open circuit, and because of that feedback, there's something called damping factor. If you use the right kind of laboratory instrumentation and you look backwards into that amplifier while it is producing audio, you're not going to see 8 ohms. You might see 1 ohm. At first, that sounds crazy. Let me jump. And it isn't because you put a transformer in there with just the right turns ratio so that it really looks like 1 ohm. You're electronically creating the 1 ohm because of the feedback network. Very similar to what LIPA and Con Ed and PSENG are doing. They would like their signal generator that's giving you 120 volts, 240 volts, and 60 cycles. They would like that signal generator to look like a micro-ohm or a nano-ohm. Therefore, you go from no load in your house to turning on all the burners on your electric range, and you turn on your electric dryer, you turn up all the heavy current stuff, and your toasters, and your hair dryer, you turn up all the heavy, and your air conditioner, all the heavy load things in your house. You go from no load to full load. You would like the 120 volts to go down to 119.9. If they succeeded in making their network look like a micro-ohm, that would happen. But there's a catch. They can't really do it that way. They do it by feedback. Their network senses the fact that an extra load was created, that the voltage started to drop. Therefore, they increase the current into the field coil of the alternator that's supplying current to your particular power station. And therefore, it comes back to normal voltage on the load. The electronic feedback is making electronically the equivalent impedance an extremely small number, even though instantaneously to the nearest microsecond, it ain't true. Same thing with the loudspeaker. So as such, it's really got an extremely small impedance compared to 8 ohms, because when a loudspeaker sees what it thinks is a short circuit, all of the acoustic resonance of your loudspeaker gets killed. We call it damping factor. If you had a loudspeaker sitting on the desk, let me drop it, and nothing connected to it, and you mount it inside of whatever loudspeaker enclosure you want to mount it into, and if you very carefully tapped the loudspeaker in a particular way, or pushed it or pulled it and then let go of it, you would hear it ring at a characteristic low note. You hear some kind of a wow note out of the loudspeaker. You put a short circuit across the terminals of the loudspeaker and repeat the experiment, and all of that sound has just disappeared. That's called the damping factor. When the loudspeaker sees what it thinks is a short circuit, all of its acoustic resonance phenomena gets killed. Now you give it a 100 hertz sine wave, a 1 kc sine wave, or a 10 kc sine wave, and it gives you just the performance you want if your signal generator is low enough impedance. That's what damping factor and feedback gives you. As such, he doesn't have to worry about the impedance being too high, as long as he's getting enough audio without flat tapping the amplifier. If he puts them in parallel and the transistors run hotter, that might not be bad. I mean, the particular transistors, there's a way he can look at the data sheet and find out what's the maximum temperature they're allowed to have of the case. And by putting a thermometer under there, in the worst case situation where he's running the 1912 overture and at full volume, and he measures the temperature of those transistors in that worst case environment, and if they're significantly below the maximum temperature of the case rating for the transistors, then maybe he's worrying unnecessarily. There's a whole lot of things going on here. KCQ, QIQ, K2RIW. Go ahead, John.
KC2WQB. Very good, Dick. I'm sure that will help him. I don't know. He did not tell me the temperature, but he says it's quite noticeable with his fingers. They get quite hot. But we have to let it drop. There may be somebody on Echolink. I know Rich is out there, K2UPS. Somebody on Echolink may have something to say, so we'll give it a couple of seconds to let her reset.
I
want to
add something there.
Hey, you've worked with an awful lot of expensive audio amplifiers, Eric. And give us enough audio, Eric, because people have been saying that they weren't getting enough audio, both on Echolink and particularly from your voice. KE2EJ, K2RIW.
Yeah, I just wanted to add, when putting speakers in serial, series, or parallel, or a combination of them, they have to stay aware of the phasing on the speakers, on the speaker terminals, either a red dot, or it'll be a red post that you make the connection to. With them in series, you got to make sure that you maintain the same thing. With the series string, then with the parallel string, you want to make sure that they're the same phase, otherwise you will physically cancel the fact that you're trying to make that information. Just go ahead and
say, yeah, good point. The most extreme case was a kind of loudspeaker that was really popular with the do-it-yourself people 30 years ago, called the Sweet 16. It took a whole lot of very inexpensive small loudspeakers that were all probably 4 inches in diameter, and you mounted these 16 speakers into one great big flat array, four wide, four high. And as long as you were sure that you had proper phasing of all the speakers, then they all would go out at the same time, and therefore your inexpensive 16 loudspeakers would act like one huge woofer, if you know what I mean. They would go from very low frequencies to very high frequencies. As long as you were mounting them on a stiff enough front plate, so to speak, that speaker, that Sweet 16, I think worked pretty well. I bet you you've run into that Sweet 16, Eric, and I bet you've seen people who did a pretty nice job. If that was put into an infinite baffle or a bass reflex baffle way back in the old days, I bet you they sounded pretty good. KE2EJ, K2LIW.
Give me 1 minute. Actually, the thing that makes that work is the reflex thing that they put in. Without it, you're kind of more poisoned. Not only that you have that nice, stiff piece of wood or whatever you're mounting on, but the reflex baffle itself and its port. So forget about it. And let that air move behind the scenes, too. Actually, the one better is we used to make these horns. These horns were about, they were rectangular, like 15 foot, maybe a 5 foot panel, and put back together. They were, each one was fed by 22 inch hardly speakers. The woman voice for them was fed, they were fed by something, fade money. They had 64, 2-inch, 30, 55 in the output. That's a differential thing, push pull. And when those things went, we had to manage 1,500 watts of each of them, right? One amplifier, 3 feet, so a constant. These were all items you can use.
Yeah, beautiful sounding thing. Once again, Eric, you moved away from the mic, and you weren't speaking very loud. We heard you. We all had to turn up our audio quite high in order to do that. So that particular rig you're using is quite shy on audio if you're not eating the mic and almost shouting into it. That's a lot of steam. So getting the mid-phase is certainly important. And you gotta be double-darn sure and check it. What some people have done is to realize that when you're on an ordinary ohm meter, a volt-ohm milliammeter on the low scale, in order to measure 0 to 100 ohms, so to speak, the ohm meter does produce a significant amount of current. So as you connect the red and black lead of your ohm meter to the loudspeaker terminals, you will watch the speaker cone either move outward or move inward, and that's telling you polarity. So even though you think you've bought 16 identical speakers, and therefore you will assume the right-hand connector is always the positive lead, so to speak, until you do that check, you can't be sure somebody didn't wind the actual coil inside the other way or wire it the other way, if you know what I mean. So you ought to check. Because in the case of something like a Sweet 16, if some of them were in phase and some of them were out of phase, you'd get some pretty crazy audio effects. And the cabinet you put the loudspeakers in is what Eric was telling us. Let me drop it. It's also very important. There's usually some kind of baffle that comes to a port, and that port is usually near the bottom or near the top of the array of speakers. And so how long is the delay path between the back of the speaker through those baffles and out that particular port, and whether or not the sound coming out of the port is now in phase with the signal coming from the front end of the loudspeaker. Depending on the frequencies of resonance of your particular loudspeaker, there are very specific ways of tuning that enclosure so you get maximum performance and flattest possible frequency response. That combined with a heavy damping factor on the amplifier that feeds the loudspeaker, put that all together just right with the right kind of a crossover network and a woofer and tweeter and a mid-range speaker, and making hi-fi is an art and a science. And when it comes to real good acoustics of a television studio, my guess is there are people who have spent a good fraction of a lifetime learning that art. Is that roughly true, Eric? And make sure you're close enough to your microphone, Eric. KE2EJ, K2LIW.
All right, K2RW, K2J, this is a different radio.
So, there's a microphone too. Actually, there are a very few number of people that know that art, and it's sort of like an art that's kind of disappearing somewhat. There are a few companies that build around one or two people that design and including the baffling systems that make my gallant telling hall and the building that makes incentives. We've got one of the guys, the same guy that did that to do our studio. It is an amazing one. Most people don't realize it's acoustic of the hall that we can set it. Actually adjustable. There's panels of Sonex and sound absorbing and reflecting seals that are all on motors that can be moved from various positions depending upon the type of production that they perform in the state. It is a very big deal. There are very few people that really understand this, and it is a very true art form. And the one most important thing is that it's totally subjective. It's just like in the eye of the beholder, well, this is in the ear of the beholder. K2RWK, 3 times.
When it comes to almost any area of high complication these days, whether it be the Large Hadron Collider, CERN, Switzerland, whether it be very elaborate antennas, when it comes to chemistry and dynamics and whatever, computer modeling has come a long way in many areas. And 95% of those areas, I think computer modeling can really give you some good answers. I'd like to believe that somewhere on planet Earth, somebody has written some real good software, some computer code, which does a medium good, if not an excellent job, of modeling the acoustics of a room, of a loudspeaker, of an infinite baffle, of a bass reflex baffle, of a Schwanden-Flugen baffle. I'd like to believe that computer modeling has helped. Is that true, Eric? K-E-2-E-J, K-2-R-I-W.
K-2-R-I-W, K-2-E-J.
We may have an audio problem. Bring that down. There actually are a few programs out there, but the best ones, the best guys, they use a program that runs on MATLAB, and it's amazing what it does, but it doesn't know how to hear, it doesn't know what sweet is, it doesn't know what warmth is, and, you know, it follows the physics, and it gets you really close, but then the human being is going to tweak it afterwards.
In almost any studio or music hall, reverberation time, I suspect, is a very important factor. If the hall is really doing its job, a man strikes a drum in the middle of the stage, the signal goes out, everybody hears that drum very nicely, the signal that hits the walls gets absorbed, and it doesn't get re-reflected from the walls back as an echo. So that reverberation time, how long it takes for an impulse to die down at various frequencies, I suspect is very important. Because the last thing you and I want to do is to be at the back of a music hall which has extremely high echo, and now you're hearing all kinds of reverberation. The worst case situation similar to that is the one that I ran into because I moved from school A to school B. I moved from Farmingdale, Weldon E. Howard High School over to the Kings Park High School when I was around 16 years of age. And the difference was extremely striking. When I went into the Kings Park High School, they had tile floors, some kind of stucco on the walls, some kind of stucco on the ceiling. The room was a huge echo chamber. Each one of those school rooms was an echo chamber. And the students in the back of the room were hearing so much echo, they couldn't understand what the teacher was saying, and they ignored the teacher, and they started playing cards. Now, the students in that particular school, a year or so later, were restricted. They weren't allowed to go to Washington, D.C. anymore because they were so disruptive. But the acoustics of that school, I think, was a great big factor. I wonder if you've heard of stories like that, Eric. K-E-2-E-J, K-2-L-I-W.
K2RWKCJ, receive a station up in a second. Actually, I'm not, I'm aware of the little stories of some of the cases in situations like that, but I don't have any direct knowledge. it's all, you know, secondhand from people who have brought it to try and solve some of those problems. But you pretty much hit it on the head, whereas you would like it to be, you know, something in the center of the stage gets projected to all four corners of the room with an equal amount of efficiency. And then it disappears, if that's the question. But interestingly enough, some stages will have, depending upon the production again, reflective walls on the stage to help project. And it's carefully placed into how fast sound travels, how much delay there is between the emanating source and the reflective source, and which are very short. But the ideal perfect listening room is equal projection for all four corners of the room and absolute absorption from both the floor, the ceiling, and the wall. That's why when it goes to a really high end place, all this stuff that looks like fancy architecture, you might see things that might have little cones on them. You know what those cones are when you go into the front of the chamber, you know, of the chambers that you have been in. Use stuff that's called sonic. Essentially, this stuff is just, I'm going to drop for a second.
Come on, speak up!
Yeah, we could use a little more audio, Eric. Okay, speak up. This stuff looks like little volcanoes on a piece of foam. And the interesting thing about it is, it's not that thick, it's maybe about 3 inches, 2-3 inches thick. Kind of expensive, but you put this stuff up, you put a sound meter on one side of it, see, say, 100 dB of sound on one side, and you put your sound meter on the other side of it, and you'll see maybe 20 or 30 dB of sound on that side. And if you coat the walls of the space, which you'll find is most typical recording studios, it doesn't absorb everything, but it sure doesn't reflect anything.
Good information, Eric, and thank you. I think I heard Joe, KG2T Mobile. Is that true? If so, go right ahead, Joe, KG2RIW.
Good evening, Dick. Yep, you're right, KG2T Mobile. Just coming back from out east, looking at the supermoon. But anyway, your subject is... very, very interesting and close to my heart. As an audio engineer, I've done many, many room acoustic analysis measurements for 40, 60, and AI, and articulation index, and so forth. All that you were talking about, Dick, it all depends on the application. If space is used for speech, then you want the room as dead as possible. You want the attenuation on the walls, you want to minimize your reflections, so this way the AI is fairly high. Generally, the outcomes, which is a loss of consonants, if it is 7% or greater, the AI is rather horrible. But now, if you switch the thing completely and you go into a musical space where music is being performed, then the opposite is what's being employed. You want the room to be reverberant, because in a dead room, music sounds dead. And to really enhance, especially the violin and the piano and those types of instruments, you do want a very lively room.
And you being as high technology as I think you are, Joe, I wonder, has anyone ever dreamed about making a variable soundstage? In other words, when you're playing voice and you're giving a speech like a TED talk, you want the room to be quite dead so that the intelligibility is very high. But if the very next day they're going to be holding a rock concert where they're going to be using... heavy metal type sounds where people just love distortion. Now you want the walls to be as reverberant as possible because you want the whole damn room to shake. You want those people to feel the music through their feet as they're jumping up and down in their seats, if you know what I mean. Has anyone ever dreamed about making a hall where the walls are somehow tunable depending on what the audience is or what the presentation is. KG2T, am I dreaming? KG2RIW in the deck, man?
No, you're not. You know, that's the ideal situation, Dick. And I think Eric explained it very clearly before when he said, when in reference to Carnegie Hall with its removable or movable, sound deflection panels. You could use that to change the acoustical parameter of the space by doing that. But it's always a compromise, let's face it. I have not seen a space designed for, let's say, speech that can be made acoustically natural, okay? I'm not talking about enhancing it electronically, because you can always add reverberation, electronically to the system. But to make the room acoustically reverberant, if you have, Sonex material on the walls, it's going to absorb the sound, and there's nothing that you can do about it. There are other methods other than Sonex, and that is a diffraction method, where you take the sound that's in back on the back wall of the auditorium, and rather than absorbing it, you diffract it. Basically, you splatter the sound. So this way that you don't have a point source coming back at you from the back of the space. Go ahead.
Yeah, I have seen a number of auditoriums where the walls are stepped in a peculiar way with angles to them, so to speak. So I can tell that they want the sound hitting the wall to not be a specular reflection, but to be scattered. They want it to be a diffused reflection. So I guess you can make the room quasi-live without drastically hurting intelligibility. When you're making specific measurements of a particular theater, is B&K one of the companies that makes instrumentation for doing that, Joe? KG2T, KG2RIW?
Yes. B&K is still one of the leading companies in terms of instrumentation, of that type. Of course, we're talking about both analog and digital meters. But when you go to computerized measurements, then there's a variety of other companies that, especially if you do modeling and computer predictions, B&K is not in that business, because that's basically a piece of software that's written to work on a Mac or a PC. And but to do actual room measurement, sound level measurement, B&K is still one of the top one companies for their equipment. And I'm going to say, you pay the price for the equipment, and it's very reliable, and it's accepted industry-wide.
In your business, Joe, are you designing halls that are about to be built in the future to meet certain parameters, or are you often called in because somebody has a hall and they want the performance for a particular application to be improved? Or which of those, or maybe there's a third factor where your skills are most used, because this is a whole area that many of us don't know very much about, and you're one of the rare guys working there, Joe. KG2T, KG2RIW.
Well, Dick, for a new space, generally, even if we called in at first, we recommend that the end user, the designer of the space, whether they be hires an acoustical consultant who can best advise them and recommend what's better for those people. We do at times offer the service as a design and build, but that's not for real performing spaces like a Carnegie Hall or a Broadway theater or places like that. Those type of places, That's where the acoustical engineer, the acoustical company comes into play.
Okay. You've told me what you don't do. Are you allowed to tell me what you do do? Over to you, Joe.
Well, in our case, most of the work that we do is basically designed by a consultant. And then, if we awarded the project, then we implement it and deliver it and work with the consultant if there's changes to be made and so forth. We do all the measurements at the end to make sure that it meets the criteria of the design. But at times, Dick, we are called in talking about, let's say, like a house of worship or a school auditorium, an existing space where they don't want to hire a consultant. They rather go directly to an integrator, a designer. In the case as such, then yes, we go in and we do the acoustical measurements, we do the predictions with the various software, Ease being one of them, and there's a couple other companies who make software that you can have predictions on what you can expect based on the location, the type of devices you're going to use, the acoustical parameter of the space, and on and on and on. I mean, it's a very complex thing. But, occasionally we're asked to come up and do it, and we do it. And but we do take exceptions. We tell the people that we are not acoustical engineers, and we'll make the best attempt. And if they really want to have guarantees, then they need to hire the people who are professionals at it. But otherwise, as I was saying originally, we work with a consultant who has designed the space, and we install the system for them.
From time to time, I have been in churches, synagogues, places of worship, where I've seen extremely good acoustics, and there was somewhere I've seen extremely bad acoustics. The ratio between those two is so extreme that the ones that are bad, I'm darn curious as to how somebody can tolerate the badness for such a long period of time without correcting it. Is it because everyone's afraid to complain, or they've never been to any other place of worship and therefore they don't know any better? I wonder if you've seen the much contrast as I've seen, Joe, and were you as amazed as I was as to how bad some of the bad ones are? KG2T, K2RIW.
Yes, I have. And Dick, I've seen projects where the end user spends a couple $100,000 for a system. And, excuse the word for guys, it's a piece of shit, basically, yeah. The end user, they spend that kind of money. It's hard for them to basically accept the fact that, there was poor judgment in that part, or sometimes they just don't know any better. And they believe what they are told, that the system is good. But yes, I've seen that on a few occasions, Dick. Where, what they bought is nothing really what they expected.
Joe, you've used a very interesting engineering term. And as I've often said, outhouse humor sometimes is pretty good. Hey, John, we've gone pretty far afield, but I think it's darn interesting. KC2WGB, K2RIW, bring our feet back down to the ground, John.
KC2WGB, well, like everything else, Dick, as soon as you start to look into the issue, it gets very wide. It goes everywhere. If we have time, I have one quick question.
These are good stuff. We're going to make time. Go for it, John.
All right. Keep in mind, this is coming from an 8.5-year-old who listens to us with her brother. Her name is Caroline. And the brother is 14 years old, and he likes the science part and you had a very interesting question. And 8.5 years old, how do they have time to think of these things? She would like to know if she had a sensitive enough scale, when you turn on a floodlight, would the light indicate any weight or pressure on the scale? And her next question, same group, is does a room weigh more with light or not? So back to you, Dick, for this one. KC2WGB.
I'm going to start off at the very beginning and say that I think I almost do not know. Everything I've heard about photon pressure, solar sails, the spacecraft, for instance, leads me to believe that the amount of force you get from even the intense light you get from the sun, that's one of the brightest objects you're ever going to encounter, the amount of force you get is extremely small. And when you build a solar sail spacecraft, and you put up a half a square mile of sail, so to speak, and you get a very, very small amount of force. The good news is the force is 24/7. The bad news is that it's extremely small. And the force that you're getting with a solar sail system spacecraft, is it really the solar wind particles? In other words, the sun is issuing zillions of pounds per second of particles that literally boil off from the surface of the sun. And they fly out at us at typically 1 or 2 million miles an hour. And when the sun really does a real good, great big burp, let me drop it.
How about a sundae?
Oh, you got to be careful. I know where you're going with this one. When the sun does one of its real big burps, you get a X-class solar flare, where two sunspots are really bouncing energy back and forth. And you get a whole bunch of particles flying out at you at 6 million miles an hour. And those particles are charged, and when they hit the Earth, the electric wiring in our power distribution system starts picking up an extremely strong DC voltage, which in some cases can wipe out power transformers at your major power stations. So it can create a lot of grief. But those are real particles. They're not necessarily the photon light. Now, when it comes to the so-called radiometer, one of these things that it's got 3 or 4 blades inside, and you put it in the sun and it rotates, you think it's the solar pressure doing it. And everything you know about solar pressure, let me drop this. Everything you know about solar pressure tells you that the sun that hits the shiny surfaces is going to hit and bounce off. The sunlight that hits the black surfaces are going to hit and get absorbed. And by all the laws of physics, of kinematics, of conservation of momentum and energy, you know that the greater amount of force must be for the silver surfaces, because not only do the light rays hit the silver surface and stop at the surface, so to speak, but then they bounce off and get re-accelerated back in the direction where they came. So you should be getting twice as much force from the silver surfaces compared to the black surfaces. Therefore, you know that when you watch that radiometer in the sun turn, you know the silver surfaces are going to move away from the sun and the black surfaces are going to move toward the sun. Okay, you go out and buy one of those radiometers, you turn it on, you put it in the sun, and it turns the wrong way. If you're smart enough to ask the question, why the hell does it turn the wrong way? And you suddenly realize something very different is going on here. I'm going to pass it over to Eric to give a few words on this one. KE2EJ, you brought it up. K2IW, detect that.
You know, I'm not going to know that. Not good. I would tickle you. But the obvious thing that you would think is that the photons are doing the pushing here. But remember, the thing's in a vacuum. So, you know, if you want to go with the thermodynamic thing, you've got a few problems. But I throw it back at you, K2RWKJ.
You brought it up, Eric. So I'm gonna needle you a little bit further. How more efficient would your radiometer, assume the Spiegel Company, a very respected firm in Plainview, makes radiometers, and the cheap ones they make have only a partial vacuum inside, but the really high-class ones
are the ones where they get down to micro pascals of air pressure inside. They get almost a near-perfect vacuum on the radiometers, the really expensive ones that the Spiegel company sells. Tell me how much faster the ones that are in the perfect vacuum, how much faster are they going to turn compared to the mediocre ones? Over to you, Eric, K2L.
Give me a second, Nick.
Kinetic energy, that is their mean speed. Notice I didn't say velocity. I said speed. Because they're bouncing all over in various directions every time they move 63 nanometers. They encounter, on average, another air molecule and bounce off at normal temperature and pressure. And so they have an average speed of 500 meters per second. The bottom of your bicycle pump, because it runs hot because of what you've done with that plunger of the bicycle pump when you're pumping up the tire, the bicycle pump runs hot, and there the air molecules might be moving almost 1,000 meters per second instead of 500 meters per second. That's what the thermometer is measuring for you, temperature. So the hotter veins take the small number of air molecules that are in that partial vacuum of your radiometer, and it causes them to bounce off the hot black surfaces. That in turn gives you a push on the blades, and therefore the hot blades move away from the sun. So it's not the solar pressure, it's not the photon pressure that moves your radiometer. It's air molecules. And you put a perfect vacuum in there, and it will not turn. So I don't know exactly what the photon pressure is. It is something above zero, but it is something so extremely small that under normal circumstances, you can talk about it as an academic subject. But we're gonna have to dig a little bit deeper into this one. We're going to give all of ourselves, everybody listening tonight, is going to do a little bit of research, I hope, to find out what is the real magnitude of solar pressure. Next sun, let me drop. At high noon, that sun is shining down on you at something in the vicinity of 1,300 watts per square meter. That is the solar, your radiant solar, power flux density is the exact word for it. The sunlight hitting a black body surface in the vicinity of the Earth, where all the sunlight gets absorbed, it's around 1,300 watts per square meter. As such, you take a pair of binoculars or a telescope, and you make the mistake of aiming it toward the sun while your eye is at that eyepiece. You are in extreme danger of permanently damaging your eye. Don't do that. So you've got to be very careful with any modern-day telescope. Make sure it doesn't come anywhere near aiming at the sun. And you got to even be careful about, you would be tempting to hold a piece of paper in front of the eyepiece and project the sunlight through the eyepiece onto the piece of paper. It turns out that sunlight going through the eyepiece is so intense that it's going to be damaging the glue that's in between the individual layers of the lens. Almost every lens in a modern day eyepiece of a telescope is a compound lens. Multiple kinds of, different kinds of refractive index glass are glued together. And that glue cannot tolerate the extreme intensity you get out of concentrated sunlight. So you'll be damaging your eyepiece if you did that. So the bottom line is, I believe light pressure is an extremely small number. Photons have so close to zero mass that it's hard to discuss them. That's my gut feel, but I haven't given you a number because I don't know a number yet. But you've tickled my curiosity on this one. And I think we've just been stumped by an 8.5-year-old, John. I think Caroline is due the prize because she asked the question of the night that I repeat her.
Time out.
I think Caroline is due the prize because she's asked the logical-sounding question of the night that I think that has stumped most of the quasi-experts that are present here right now. KC2WGB, are you going to tell her what the prize is, John? KC2WGB, K2RIW.
Dick, I'm stumped to the point that what is an 8.5-year-old child doing thinking about things like this? It's amazing. I want to thank Caroline for this great question, and any younger people out there that have questions, no matter what they think, silly or not, if they have a question, please forward it on the email, and I will present it. We'll review that. It's always a pleasure to hear from these youngsters, and I hope your brother is enjoying the net, too. So, just great stuff, Dick. I love it. KC2WGB. I think it's time for Paul. Maybe he fell asleep. Back to you, Dick.
Now, Paul has all been queued up. to give us a space report number 110. Last week we saw 109. I think he keeps numbers somewhat like that. Whereas the TechNet you're listening to right now is TechNet number 1516, 1500, and 1516 is this particular TechNet of the series that began way back in 1982. Hey, Paul, as you go from one astronomical unit where the Earth is located to 39 astronomical units where Pluto is, way out there. Pluto, to me, is still a planet. Maybe to you it still is. Even though it's a trans-Neptunian object that, to some degree, looks like it's part of the Kuiper belt. And it hasn't gone as far as the Oort cloud yet, but I think it's part of the Kuiper belt. And here we are with Voyager out there, not at 39 astronomical units of Pluto, but something like 128 astronomical units, 8 billion miles. And if you did a computer simulation of what does the sun look like when you look back toward the center of this solar system from that distance, my guess is it's a very minor star by comparison to what we see. And can you imagine calculating the amount of solar pressure out there? I think I told you guys about the fact that the European Southern Observatory had a great big breakthrough 2 years or so ago. Let me drop. Where their fanciest, great, big telescope with huge mirrors, state-of-the-art mirrors, mounted on top of the quietest, darkest mountain that they could find, so to speak, in La Salina, Chile, where the European Southern Observatory, Optical Astronomy Observatory, is located. They managed to capture the light reflected off that thing that's as dark as a piece of coal. It's called Halley's Comet. Halley's Comet is what we call it. Halley's Comet is what the astronomers call it. But the family name is Halley. So Halley's Comet, that's the way the family pronounced that name. When it's way out there where it is at its aphelion, the furthest it gets away from the sun, they managed to measure the light reflected off Halley's Comet. And it was something like one photon per second they were gathering when they did this integrated picture, one photon per second, in order to finally draw a picture, so to speak, of Halley's Comet at its maximum distance. So modern-day telescopes can do some things that you couldn't even dream about. WS2N, what's NASA doing? And once again, tell me what my favorite Voyager is doing. WS2N, K2LIW.
This is WS2N. Very good, Dick. Your favorite one, that's Voyager 1. You're almost up to 129. It's 128.6 or something. And the other one is not far behind. Voyager 2 is 105. So that's roughly 105 and a half. And that's measurements from the sun. And when I think of like some of these exoplanets or Newtonian planets, rather, similar to Pluto, and they're out of 80 or 89 AU. And Voyager is way past that. We're almost at 130. So that's an amazing thought. And I know the question, the earliest question, at the beginning of the net, about the tracking. They have celestial navigation. They have gyros, but they really don't need them anymore. We drop it. They run on a dead band system. Over time, they've adjusted the position. It's not a spin satellite, stabilized satellite. It runs on this dead band system, stays in one position. And by hitting a little thruster here, a little thruster there over months and then eventually years, once in a while they give it a blast if that starts to move a little too far one way or the other, where the antenna can't see the Earth, they'll give it another blast. And they have enough fuel on board to keep this up. And I was just reading that another couple of decades is possible. So, but they got to cut back on on power usage. They've done quite a bit of that over the years. A lot of systems are shut down, like cameras and things they don't want to be using it. And, you know, you're running on the downside through 300, they're getting close to 300 watts, I think it was 320 or something last time I read. Boys is interesting, and we'll talk about them, and the next one will be a new horizon past Pluto that will eventually leave the solar system as well. Let me drop it.
By the way, Paul, is New Horizons going to be passing Pluto at a higher velocity than Voyager did? Go ahead.
Yeah, well, both Voyagers didn't pass Pluto at all, but, similar to passing Uranus, Neptune, of course. They're taking pictures now. They've already taken a picture, getting ready. But for next year's, right around there, Independence Day is when that's going to happen next year. But, they'll be taking pictures, months and then days and then months, a lot of pictures. It's all orchestrated. They want to take pictures of the moons, and five moons. How many pictures can they get before the thing takes off to the Kuiper Belt? I don't know. But it's going to be very interesting. See close-ups. I've seen artist renditions, but now compare the real thing to what the artist has done. That should be really very interesting sight. So much for New Horizons. I want to talk about Rosetta. Is the European Space Agency spacecraft that left 10 years ago, and now it's right on top of its comet 67P. In fact, last week it completed its rendezvous, so it's got its braking jets on, and it's just like going with it now. I think it's twice a week they're going to adjust their orbit to try to eventually get a circular orbit. Look at one of the websites on the European Space Agency site. They show these different maneuvers. It's complex. It looks like it's a triangular orbit in the beginning. It's impossible, but that'll be a
repeater. Timeout. Repeater. Timeout. Cancel.
Into a circular orbit around this comet that looks like, like a dumbbell. It's not a big ball floating through space. It's a dumbbell-looking shape. And the exciting part should be in November. To leap the onboard lander, separates from the mothership and goes down to the comet and lands there. It's got these harpoon-like things that are going to dig into the surface of the comet and try to hold it so it doesn't bounce away. And then even after it lands, the landing legs themselves have these screw-type motors. Motors with screw, like a big legs on them that are going to drill themselves into the comet. So Philippe stays there. On board that, they have about 10 different instruments. Some of them are sponsored by NASA, as well as I think one or two on board Rosetta. So NASA's involved with this program to some degree, even though it was launched by Ariane 5 rocket 10 years ago from French Guiana. That's pretty much a major European Space Agency project. NASA is involved with them, of course, and we'll be getting a lot of science for a shared investment into that spacecraft. So anybody has any questions on Rosetta, we'll cover that at the end. But the next thing I want to talk about is Curiosity. I remember it seemed like yesterday we were sitting here talking about this thing going through this complicated procedure on how it landed on Mars, and that's 2 years ago, so it's a little over one Mars year. So it's gone through all the seasons of Mars. It's done its job. It's proved that there was water there at one time. It found clay, which means to have clay, you had to have water at one time. So it really has done its job. It hasn't gotten to its prime location yet, Mount Sharp. That should take another year. But it's doing good.